Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padre Greedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and tonight's show features a pre-recorded interview with the writer Alex Belos. Alex Belos has a degree in mathematics and philosophy. He has worked for The Guardian in London and Rio de Janeiro, where he was the paper's foreign correspondent. In 2002, he wrote a critically acclaimed book about Brazilian football, and in 2006, he ghost-wrote Pelé's autobiography, which was a number one bestseller. His latest book is Alex's Adventures in Numberland, Dispatches from the Wonderful World of Mathematics. Alex, welcome to Little Atoms. Thanks for speaking to me today.
Thank you.
We should talk about, first of all, why you decided to write a book about maths, because that must have been quite a hard sell.
Well, weirdly, it was quite an easy sell. In my history, I was very good at maths at quite a young age. I mean, I was not a prodigy or anything like that, but I was pretty good. You know, I was sort of didn't my O-level a couple of years before I should have done. Then I went to university age 17, studied maths and philosophy at university, but I kind of got sidetracked by journalism, and so I edited the university paper. Then I went to work for the Brighton Evening Argus. Then I went to London to work in papers. Then I went to Brazil to work in newspapers to be a foreign correspondent. And all of a sudden, I kind of woke up in my mid-30s, and I thought, hang on a second, actually what my kind of first love was, what my first interest, what my real unique selling point was I was the guy that was good at maths. And, you know, I think I was an okay journalist, but I don't think I was never as good a journalist as I was good at maths when I was a kid. So I thought, well, now, you know, it's been almost 20 years out of maths, why don't I go back and explore and see if coming with older eyes and with an ability to write, I can sort of make something of it. So I wrote a proposal. And when the proposal went out, it was surprising how quickly people came back with, yes, we'd love to buy this book. And I think one of the reasons was that, you know, as a foreign correspondent in Brazil, what you need to be really good at is pitching. Mm-hmm. The most important thing of your job is calling up the office and saying, hey, there's this weird thing that's going on in Brazil that you've never heard of, and this is why it's interesting. So actually, I'm quite good at that pitch. And so what my proposal was, I knew it was aimed at people who had never read or studied maths, or knew anything about maths at all, i.e. everyone in publishing. And I knew that because I had this authority, because I've got a degree in maths, I knew I could kind of say, you know, I'm the guy who's going to be able to make maths fun. And not many people can do that. And I think there's always this feeling that everyone's really wanted someone to make maths interesting for people who find it difficult and dry. And I look back now at my proposal, I'm almost a bit embarrassed because I really did promise the world. I said things like, you know, I'll be able to explain long division, you know, without getting encumbered with numbers. You know, it's like absolutely impossible to do. But it's exactly the sort of thing that someone who can't do long division wants to be told. And I guess that's also the good thing about non-fiction books, is that you just need to write a proposal and then you get the deal. Rather than in fiction, you kind of often need to write the entire book first.
Yeah, sure.
So the proposal really promised so much, and I didn't really know at that time that I would be able to deliver it. But I thought, if I can persuade people that I could, it's quite good. You set the bar really high, and then you really have got to go for it and really try and do it. And the proposal, you know, what I was trying to do at the beginning changed massively to what it ended up being. At the beginning, I thought what I wanted to do was to take the GCSE syllabus and explain it in layman's terms, maybe almost like a textbook, so people could, who wanted to understand about math but were a bit afraid of it, could read it. Then I realised actually lots of, you know, firstly there's too much of it, lots of it is irrelevant and a bit boring, and I think that as a writer, when you write a book, you've got to go with what you're interested in, because if you go with what you're not interested in, the reader can tell. Mm-hmm. So I quite quickly thought, well, this is what interests me, well, that's what interests me. And also what I realised my skill is, just through experience, is getting on a plane, travelling somewhere, interviewing someone and writing up mm-hmm. my story, because that's what I've done for, well, for 5 years in Brazil, then for 5 years after that. So I thought, okay, I'm going to travel the world and make it more of a sort of maths odyssey, which is brilliant fun to do. I found out loads of stuff that I didn't know, and I think that's what makes the book, that's part of its success, is that it's my rediscovery. It's not just me rattling off the stuff I learned at school.
Mm-hmm.
It's me finding out new stuff and getting excited by it.
And that's what the book is. It's a collection of interesting stories about interesting people and concepts. But before we actually look at some of those, I just want to sort of carry on what you're talking about there, really. Because so what happens now? Because now you're the maths guy. So now do you get to go on to do some of those things that perhaps didn't happen with this book?
Yeah, I've recently written a proposal for Numberland 2. It's not going to be called that. I'm not too sure what it's going to be called. To do loads of stuff that didn't get in the first one. I mean, math is such a massive subject now. I think we think that, oh, math, it's all the same, it's all the kind of abstract stuff. But actually, I'd say math is probably wider than physics, chemistry or biology, especially in terms of, it's impossible really for any one person to have a proper overview of what's going on in maths anymore. Trigonometry, quite important for maths. You know, there is no mention of the sine or the cosine in my first book. And that's a massive part of maths. You know, you really need to understand about that. So I want to go into that. And that's kind of quite fun, because trigonometry is all about, you know, mapping the world and maps and the sine curves and music and waves and things like that. So there's lots of material for sort of great stories and great interviews. Also, I didn't really go into sort of computers or computer theory very much. And I'm not a programmer myself, but I think there's lots of interesting basic computer stuff that is easy to explain that most people just don't know. And also there are great stories. And now I've got a bit more profile, really. I'd hope I could get some really good interviews, because I'm never going to be the mathematician writing about his view on maths. I'm going to be the maths journalist doing more reportage, and sort of that's what I'm happy doing. And, you know, I'm quite happy in the sort of role of popularizer. And I think sometimes to be a good popularizer, or the most successful popularizers, haven't actually been scientists. Mm-hmm. You know, the best case in point is Martin Gardner,
mm-hmm.
who is peerless in his writing about math, and he never studied it beyond, you know, age 17. Only started writing about it again aged about 40. And the reason why it's so good is that he really had to understand it from its most basic principles. So he was just brilliant at explaining it.
Well, let's dive straight in with Martin Gardner as an example there, because Martin Gardner, who very recently passed away, but in the book you go to a conference that's held in his honour. So let's talk about that first.
Well, Martin Gardner wrote a column in Scientific American from 1958, I think, until about 1982. And it was every month, and it was the most popular thing in Scientific American, which is quite interesting to think that what's the math column that everyone, or the math column that everyone wants to find out about. But his take was the recreational math, and this could be everything from puzzles, but as well as puzzles, just sort of stories about maths. It was the beginning of kind of computing, so there were quite a lot of the origin of sort of hacking and things like that were subjects for him. He was also wrote about philosophy and physics, so he could write stories about math, say the history of pi or of E or something like that, and he would have all this brilliant references to put it in context. And he had this huge, huge fan base, and he was also a very shy man. He didn't really like to do any travelling. He was one of those people that just stayed at home or researched in the library. And his fans said, well, I think the original reason to have a conference in his honour was so that lots of his fans could meet him, and it would be a very efficient way of doing that. And then I think he went to the first couple. The first one was about 10, 15 years ago, called the Gathering for Gardner, or G4G. And so now there's been 9 of them. So the last one was the G4G9. I guess the next one will be the G4G10. Now, they happen every 2 years now in Atlanta, and they have gone beyond just being about Martin Gardner, and really it's a celebration of fun things you can do with maths, and you get such a wide array of people. Actually, when I say maths, it's not just maths, because his specialty was maths, puzzles, and magic. He loved magic. So you get people from the magic sort of business. So you get actually, you know, proper magicians, like a guy called Lennart Green, the Swedish guy. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Unbelievably good close-up magic. Absolutely wonderful. You get sort of puzzle makers. So you get people who are in their woodwork labs or warehouses, you know, doing their amazing wooden puzzles. And you get some of the best mathematicians of the day. Case in point, John Conway, the sort of Liverpudlian, who is probably one of the most brilliant mathematicians of the last 50 years. And it's, you know, it's really good fun.
Let's go back to the right to the beginning of the book there. And, numbers were, it sounds a weird way to say it, but I suppose invented, really. We didn't obviously always use numbers, and then at some point we did. So let's talk about when we first started using numbers, and then basically how that, I suppose going on from that, how that then changed us, really.
One of the things I did at the beginning was to look at absolutely everything, and anything that caught my eye, I think, oh, hang on, I want to find more about that. And when I learned that there are lots of tribes still in the jungle that don't have numbers, I was like, hey, how does that work? Come on, you know, they can't say, I want 5 chickens or something. So I found, you know, I read a lot of research about it, and I interviewed people who do research who go live in the jungle, and it's true. And when you think about it, you actually don't need numbers to survive as a hunter-gatherer, because you hunt as much as you can get, fish as much as you can fish, you eat it, then you don't really save things. There's no agriculture, so you don't need to measure bits of grain. There's no time, because you just, if it's sunny, you go out, and also the equator's at the same time the whole time. And what's interesting is that sometimes you can take these Indians who don't have numbers out of their hunter-gatherer community, for example, to, they're ill, and, you know, a missionary takes them out to a hospital, and then you can kind of teach them numbers. But very quickly, when they go back into their community, they totally lose the ability to use numbers. And actually, one of the researchers, a sort of very esteemed linguist called Pierre Pica from Paris, who spends about 3 months of the year with these Indians researching their sort of cognitive abilities, he kind of loses the ability to use numbers when he comes back. And I found this when I went to interview him. The first thing I said, well, can I come and see you next week? And he goes, yeah, fine, brilliant. And then the following day, he emailed me and said, well, Alex, what time are you arriving this afternoon? I said, no, it was never this afternoon, it's next week. And then when I finally did meet him, I would say things like, oh, so how long were you there? And he'd be, I don't know. And I'm like, well, could you just give me like 1 day, 1 week, 1 year? And it made me realise that as a journalist, I'm constantly just trying to quantify. And it's that's actually quite weird. And I realised that he was totally unable. He'd sort of unlearnt how to quantify. And that makes you realise, or it's one of the things that brings out the fact that numbers are very recent. Say 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years old. If what we mean by numbers are sort of a system of numbers where you can say, you can count beyond 5, and you can have symbols that are more than just tallying. And that happened in Sumer, which is present-day Iraq. And it was because of trade and because of agriculture, much easier to talk about your 100 head of cattle if you had a little stone that had a little mark which meant 100, rather than writing 100 notches and coming with like a massive bone, say, with 100 notches on. Much better if you could sort of abbreviate it. And so they started to have little tablets, little, you know, clay tablets, which had different symbols that were marked on them for numbers. And actually, the symbols used for numbers that the Sumerians used was the first evidence that we have of sort of Western writing systems and scripts. So it's fair to say that written literature only exists as a result of numbers.
Something else that we would take for granted, because it's a system that we use and it seems incredibly natural, is the base 10 system, that we can do everything in 10. But again, this is of course an entirely artificial system that we've invented, and there are people that think there are better systems. So let's perhaps talk about that. Why do we use base 10, and why would base 12 be better?
Base 10 has been used because it would seem obvious. We have 5 fingers, including thumbs, and 1 hand, 5 on the other. So the logical systems to take for humans to have chosen, since we really did choose them, would be either base 5, base 10, or base 20. Base 5 is just a bit too small. Base 20 is just a bit too big. So base 10 kind of fits pretty good, but mathematically speaking, base 12, which would mean we have 12 single digits and 10 would be 12, is much better for arithmetic uses. And in the 19th century, when a lot more mental arithmetic was done, there were campaigns to try and bring in base 12. And, you know, we can think about, well, how does it make it arithmetically better? Let's talk about our multiplication tables. What are the easiest multiplication tables the way we have now with base 10? Then your 2 times table, because it's just 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and then 1, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, carries on to even numbers. Or 5, which is just easy. It's 5, 10, 15, 20, etc. Not many people do, but if you begin to think, well, why are those two ones easiest? They're easiest, obviously, because 2 and 5 divide into 10. But not very many things divide into 10, i.e. just 2 does and 5 does. If you have 12, 2, 3, 4, and 6 divide into 12, which means that the 2, 3, 4, and 6 times tables in base 12 would be just as easy as the 2 and 5 times table are now. So, for example, the 2 times table would be even numbers. The 3 times table would be 3, 6, 9, then 1, 0, 12. Then it would be 1, 3, 1, 6, 1, 9, then 2, 0. Brilliant. Really, really easy. You instantly know something's divisible by 3 because it's ending. Same thing with 4. The 4 times table would be 4, 8, 1, 0, 1, 4, 1, 8, 2, 0. And 6 times table, equally 6, 0, 6, 0. So if we're doing lots of calculation, then it makes sense to have a base system for facility of use. So it is a better system arithmetically, although once we have a base 10 system, to try and introduce base 12 is an absolutely lunatic idea, and no one's ever going to do it. But it is fascinating just to point out and think, well, actually, why do we have base 10? And because it makes you, I think, much more supple when you think about why we have numbers and what numbers are there for, and the fact that our relationship with numbers is very human and very cultural and not fixed.
How is this linked to decimalisation? Because we did have, you know, there is a dozen, for instance, and then pounds and ounces.
Well, I think that one reason why feet is preferred by carpenters, for instance, is that if you have 12 inches, you can divide 12 into 3 or into 4, and you get a clean amount of inches. You can't do that with, say, 100 centimetres. So, and also, the reason, actually, we talk about, you know, grocers, say, preferring, ounces. The reason a grocer is called a grocer is because the word gross means 144, which is 12 times 12, because grocers used, you know, did things in 12s, because it's much easier if you buy things or supply things in 12s, then if someone says, yeah, I'll have half of that, I'll have a quarter of that, or I'll have a third of that, which are the things that people are going to be wanting to ask for, you can do it. You can't do that if you buy things in 10s, for example. So 12 is much more easy for everyday use, although once you have base 10, you're never going to change to 12.
You mentioned the, you know, the idea that numbers haven't been around that long in terms of human history. But one of the things I was unaware about and I found really fascinating is the first chapter in the book on India, which is, we'll talk about zero separately, but basically you talk about big numbers and like in insanely big numbers that were used a very long time ago in Buddhist spiritual practice, but obviously had no practical application. And yet they were, you know, let's talk about that. They were playing with these, like, insanely huge numbers.
Yeah, I think that when you were a kid, you say, what's the biggest number? And then they say, oh, infinity. Well, what's infinity plus one? I think the Indians were sort of playing that game, but they took it a lot more seriously. So they would say, well, what's bigger than 1,000? Oh, you know, 10,000. What's bigger than 10,000? They went on. And if you read or sort of research some of those early Indian texts, or you can't really call them texts because they're sort of handed down orally, they have the most absurdly big numbers. I think the largest one that crops up is 10 to the 240, which is 10 with sort of 240 zeros on it, which is, you know, it's a page of writing, which, you know, there's nothing in the universe really that you're ever going to need that amount. I mean, something like all the particles in the entire universe is maybe 10 to the 60 or 10 to the 70, around about that. So this is, it's just sort of mind-boggling. So obviously, they're not trying to talk about anything you need. They're trying to get closer to infinity, to get closer to eternity, to sort of get closer to God. And they had a very interesting, different attitude to that. And it's actually the mystical approach that Indians had to this idea of getting bigger and bigger, and actually getting bigger is like getting smaller, and infinity is the flip side of nothingness, and nothingness is eternity, and etc., etc., that led to the discovery of mathematical zero, which was possibly the greatest advance in maths in human history.
You talked to, at one point, you interview an Indian mathematician who is also a Hindu spiritual leader.
Shankaracharya.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who is also a published mathematician. So let's talk about that link, the link between sort of Hinduism and maths.
I went to India because I wanted to try and find out why, in India of all places, did they make this great mathematical leap to have the zero.
Which is zero. Which again is something that people might not be aware of, was, somebody came up with the idea quite a long time after we had numbers.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't realise it, but everyone knows Roman numerals. They're kind of easy, and the beginning of book chapters are often sort of Roman numerals. But there's no zero in Roman numerals. And actually, that was, not having a zero was one thing that kept Roman mathematics back. And the zero comes from India. And so I kind of wanted to find out, what is it about India that brought them this idea of zero? So I found out about this Shankaracharya of Puri, who's one of the most spiritual men sort of in Hinduism, and who is also a published mathematician. I mean, he hasn't published brilliant maths. It's more he writes stuff about how maths is linked to spirituality. But still, there are numbers in his books which I've seen. And I realised when I was talking to him that he sort of embodies nothingness. It's all about, he wears just this tiny little robe. He lives with no possessions. When people give him gifts, he gives them away. And it's very clear when you're in India that that sort of letting go, that, nirvana, what they're sort of striving for is this idea of nothingness. But nothingness being something, and that's exactly what zero is. Before there was the symbol zero for zero, zero is nothing. So how can you have a sign for something which is nothing? It's such a conceptual leap that if you think back, say, to Greek and Roman times, they used the abacus. An abacus has different rods for different powers of 10. So the rightmost rod will be anything from 0 to 9. The next one will be for anything from 10 to 90. If you have one of the rods which doesn't have the bead, the bead that's all at the 0 state, you've actually got the 0 position. So they had the 0 position, and they used 0 for doing all their calculating. But the Romans and Greeks never came up with a word for it, which is kind of fascinating. You think, well, God, they must be really stupid. But no, the idea that something which is that nothing has a symbol is really, it's a huge leap, and it was only done by the Indians in about 400 AD.
So let's talk about once that had happened, once we'd got the concept of zero, how did that change maths? How did maths then go on to make such leaps from that concept?
Well, once you have a good number system, it means it's easier to count. It means it's possible to do arithmetic. It democratizes maths. Sort of chart the history of what happened when zero was invented. It was invented in India around about 400. Then it came through the Arab world, and between about 500 and, say, 1,200, 300, the Arab world really was the centre of mathematics. And armed with this new, they had the stuff from the Greeks that they'd taken, and they had this new zero. So for that period of sort of half a millennium, if not approaching a millennium, the Arab world was the centre, and they made the best advances in science. The Arab world had these numbers up to basically North Africa, and it was an Italian, Fibonacci, who grew up in North Africa, who realised that this number system was sort of amazing, wrote a book, The Liber Abaci, about it. Once Europe started to have these numbers, all of a sudden, really, science could be invented. You can't really do science if you don't have a proper way of counting, because with these numbers, you can measure things better, you can calculate, and the Enlightenment would not have happened if there weren't numbers.
You're listening to Little Atoms, this week with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Alex Bellos about his book, Alex's Adventures in Numberland. So you've just raised the character of Fibonacci. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Fibonacci sequence and about this idea of the golden ratio.
Yeah.
which is something that people seem to think crops up quite a lot in nature. So tell us what those things are.
Well, the Fibonacci sequence is the most famous sequence in maths, I guess, beyond the natural numbers. And it starts 0, and then the next one is 1. And then once you've got 2, all you do is you add the two most recent numbers in the sequence to make the one after that. So 0 and 1, then you get 1. Then 1 and 1 is 2. Then 2 and 1 is 3. Then 2 and 3 is 5. Then 3 and 5 is 8. Then 5 and 8 is 13, etc., etc., etc. It goes on. So these are the numbers. And does crop up in nature. You can look at the number of petals, for example, on many plants, almost always their Fibonacci numbers. If you look at the number of spirals in sort of seed plants, things like pineapples or pine cones, they're always fiber. They're always consecutive Fibonacci numbers because you can see the spirals go two ways. And another thing that you also find in nature is the golden ratio. And the golden ratio is the number that the ratio of consecutive Fibonacci terms approaches in the limit. In other words, if the Fibonacci series is 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 8 over 5 is almost the golden ratio, and then 13 over 8, and then 21 over 13. And basically that fraction approaches 1.618, which is the golden ratio. And that number, when you see things in these ratios, 1.618, sort of all over the place. And the big controversy is, if it's not a controversy, is that from about 500 years ago, artists and thinkers have began to say that actually all beauty, wherever there's beauty, there's the golden ratio. So you get people looking at the great paintings of Leonardo da Vinci, people like that, and spotting the golden ratio, and then saying, well, these amazing bits of music, well, there's the golden ratio in that. And that is, some mathematicians will laugh at you to talk about that because they say it's just completely bogus, whereas lots of serious researchers do believe that there's something to it. And in my book, I didn't want to take sides. I mean, I'm kind of very suspicious about people saying, you know, there is a formula for beauty and it's X, because it seems to me that's just not the way that the world is. On the other hand, the reasons these numbers and these ratios occur is because they're organic. It's about sort of life growing. And it's sort of obvious that we would be attracted to things that grow in a very natural, organic way. So it's definitely entertaining and interesting to talk about. But, you know, the guy who I spoke to who says, oh, it's wherever there's beauty, there's a golden ratio. He gave me all the examples of beauty and these great paintings, and then he showed me a picture of a Fiat Uno. You're going to find that's nobody's definition of beauty.
It's interesting that, I mean, we've talked about the influence in Hinduism and Buddhism, but and it's interesting how much spirituality, and even sort of some sort of bogus spirituality, there often is in maths. I mean, it does, when you talk about this golden ratio, it does seem like because mathematicians are perhaps often looking for simpler and simpler rules in the same way that, you know, physics does, it's almost like there's an implicit need to find some sort of hidden hand almost in this.
Yeah, I think that lots of people feel that math in itself is a bit like a religion, because everything is either right or wrong, and it inhabits in this sort of perfect world. Yeah, and people like that. And also, people like to see patterns often when there are none. And so when you see these patterns in nature, you like to imagine the hand of a designer or a creator. So you do get lots of spiritual people who are attracted to math. And there's a whole literature of, for instance, numerology, which is, you know, the importance of, you know, five-pointed triangles and, you know, rubbish like that.
And there's the Kabbalah.
And Kabbalah, yeah, but that's not really math. And I tried to steer clear of any of that in my book, but I wanted to mention it. And actually, I mentioned it a few times, but I think it's so sort of ridiculous that I thought it would be just obvious if I said, by the way, in brackets, this bit is quite ridiculous. I thought it's ridiculous and this stands out for itself. But I have had some criticisms, like, well, the thing about Alex's book, you know, he's not harsh enough on the sort of mumbo-jumbo people. But, you know, I think it's an easy target, so let them just fall into the hole that they make for themselves.
Well, let's move on to another area of maths that, if not necessarily mumbo-jumbo, does have, like, an insane hold on people's imaginations, and that's the idea of pi.
Yeah.
And there are these, you know, the competitions where people recite pi to
Well, pi is absolutely fascinating, and it's nice because it's very simple to explain. And the reason why it's interesting is also very simple to explain. You know, pi is the ratio between the circumference and diameter. In other words, between the perimeter and the breadth. So if you want to get the diameter of a circle and lay it around the circumference, it goes 3.14 times. So that's what it is. It's the most simple ratio of the most simple object in maths, or, you know, in geometry, or in human culture, I suppose. And now we have the decimal system. People have tried to find out, well, what is this number, which is the ratio, because it doesn't, you know, whatever circle you have, it doesn't change. And there is no pattern in it. And actually, the quest to find more and more digits in pi is a brilliant romantic quest, which is a great story to tell about how people have attacked it in different ways. And now we know it to, you know, 3 trillion or so decimal places. We don't need that for any practical use, but it's just interesting looking at how these numbers appear, because it appears that they are totally random, but sort of brilliantly, wonderfully random in a way which, does randomness even exist? This is a big philosophical point. And it seems to exist brilliantly in pi, but then pi is self-evidently not random because we know exactly what it is. So there are these kind of quite interesting, very deep issues, which that's about as much as we know about pi, you know, and I've said it in like 30 seconds.
All right, well, we'll move on from the book now. You've literally days ago just come back from India, having been attending the latest International Congress of
Mathematicians, yeah,
which is a 4-yearly gathering. So tell us what that was like.
Well, the International Congress of Mathematicians is not like, I don't think, any other scientific or maybe even academic convention. Firstly, there's the history of it. The first one was in 1897. The second one then was in 1900, after 3 years, and then it became every 4 years with breaks for the war. And then the one in 1900, David Hilbert, one of the greatest mathematicians of that era, if not of all time, stated 23 unsolved problems. And the questions that he stated at this very famous speech have really defined the last century of mathematics. And because math is something where you do spend so much time on your own thinking, something was needed to bring mathematicians together. So they come together and they discuss, you know, where the subject has been going the last few years and where it's going to go. And because math is now so massive and so complicated, even to mathematicians, they divide it into 20 or so areas, and this top person in that area will give a lecture trying to explain to the others what's been going on in their area. So it's a little bit like, you know, the best guy at trigonometry tries to explain the latest. And probably a fraction of the people listening will understand it, because it's very difficult to understand math that you're not immersed in. And once you're immersed in it, it gets so narrow so quickly that if you're on the frontier, there's probably no more than, you know, a dozen people who really understand what you're doing. And so I was sort of fascinated, you know, so what do these people who they speak the same language with, but do they actually speak the same language, talk about? You know, what do they look like? How old are they? How many women are there? And where is maths going? And also, you get to see the stars, because at the International Congress is where they announce the Fields Medals, which are the Nobel Prizes of maths. And they announce between 2 to 4 in each Congress. So it works out basically about 1 a year. And they're given to mathematicians who are under 40. And that's also interesting. So they're giving the highest prize in math to someone who is 40. And it's not the case that you'll be burnt out by the time you're 40. Lots of brilliant mathematicians do great work in their 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s. But what it does is that it gives you these sort of young heroes, and it makes the subject feel sort of dynamic and alive. And these people have been awarded it for, you know, amazing ability and things that they have proved, but also for promise, for what they're going to prove. So it makes it kind of quite exciting. And actually, it's more exciting giving an award to someone in their prime rather than maybe someone towards the end of their lives for lifetime achievement.
So can you give us an example, perhaps just one of those 4 winners, who they were and what they have won for?
Yeah.
You don't have to explain it.
Well, I obviously didn't understand any of it at all. And I can read you, in fact, when they're given the awards, they're given a small citation for what they've won for. And I'll just read, say, the first honour. So the first one, Israeli, called Elon Lindenstrauss, who won for his results on measure rigidity ergodic theory and their applications to number theory. So I don't know what measure rigidity is. Or measure rigidity, sorry, in ergodic theory. I don't know what ergodic theory is. Although, being there and sort of talking about it, ergodic theory is interesting because it's actually an applied bit of math to do with, I think, originally orbit of planets and things like that. And he found some results of that that applied to number theory. And number theory is very obvious. Number theory is, you know, prime numbers, what goes on with numbers, patterns of numbers. So what's kind of interesting there, even though I don't understand it at all, there's no way I could ever understand it, is that he's taken some result in applied math and it's had some interesting results in pure math. So what you're seeing kind of on the frontier is that these barriers between pure and applied are kind of breaking down. And that's kind of interesting. And, you know, let's go to the next one. Ngobao Chow, he won for his proof of the fundamental lemma in the theory of automorphic forms through the introduction of new algebra-geometric methods. And, you know, you can even ask a Fields medalist from another discipline, what is an automorphic form? And they're just not going to know. And here, I mean, maybe one thing just to point out, which is kind of interesting, is that this thing called the fundamental lemma, and that's, you know, capital F, capital L, has been quite a big thing that people have been wanting to prove. A lemma is like an intermediate, small, kind of slightly irrelevant result. You know, when you have a big proof, you might halfway through say, oh, there's this little thing that it proves. And so you call it a lemma. But this small little thing that people was a lemma that people wanted to prove actually has turned out to be incredibly fundamental and important. So actually the term fundamental lemma, it's almost like a self-contradiction. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the most fun guy who I met there, or the most charismatic guy, mathematicians, they're just like most people, but maybe slightly more male, maybe slightly shyer, slightly nerdier, is the guy Cedric Villani, or Villani, who is French and who also won the Fields Medal. And he looked like Marcel Proust. I mean, he was brilliant. He had this kind of centre parting, and he had this three-piece suit, and he had this big kind of velvet bow tie thing that was just like the size of a cravat, and a brooch with sort of silver spider, and he always wears this brooch. And he was, where he went, people were asking for his autograph and having their picture taken with him. And he's very eloquent and very, you know, quite extrovert. And that was kind of interesting, seeing, you know, there are stars and there are people who, you know, like to be very stylized. And his work is in entropy. It's quite near to physics. Basically, he worked out some mathematical equations for entropy to do with the Boltzmann equation, which is, you know, 150 years old, to do with behaviour of gases. It's sort of interesting the way that, you know, physics and maths and chemistry and applied pure maths are all sort of mixing together to go in new directions at the moment.
We'll have to finish it there, Alex. Thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.